Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I'm Les Schulte. I'm sitting in for David Inge this morning. I think this is going to be a really fun hour, especially if you're a fan of the movies and the old movies, the movies of the World War II era. Our guests this hour are Robert L. McLaughlin and Sally E. Perry. They have written a book called We'll Always Have the Movies. This is a product of the screening of over 600 films of the period. We'll Always Have the Movies defines the power of the cinema against those who dismiss wartime films as propaganda and demonstrates not only the impact of these films on World War II audiences, but also their role in shaping historical understanding of future generations. Robert McLaughlin is an associate professor of English at Illinois State University, and he is editor of Innovations, an anthology of modern and contemporary fiction. Sally E. Perry is associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Illinois State University. She is editor of The Minnesota Stories of Sinclair Lewis and Go East, Young Man, Sinclair Lewis on Class in America. And good morning to both of you, to Robert and Sally. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking time to be on the program today.
Oh, we're always delighted to talk about our book.
Well, you know, first off, I have to say thank you because you gave me a reason to go get Casablanca and sit down and watch it yesterday as part of my Father's Day present.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You know, you can't bother me. I'm working here. I have to watch this movie. And it's one of my favorite films. So so I'm hoping that we can talk, about Casablanca here a little bit later on.
And
first off, if you had to watch 600 films, how do you start a project like that? How do you classify what you're going to watch? Do you watch them in chronological order, or how do you begin a project like this?
And I wish we could say it was that organized. When we first started doing this, we were looking at a much smaller sample, and we had done some papers at, like, the Popular Culture Association conference on World War II films, and someone there suggested, you know, you guys ought to do a book on this, and we really hadn't thought of it, and we looked at each other and said, yeah, we should. And we did a book outline, and I think at that point we were probably thinking about maybe 15 movies that we thought were really representative, but then, you know, it's like potato chips. Once you start, you can't stop. Mm-hmm. We added more and more and more, and I think there are some that we would like to see we still haven't been able to find copies of, but we're looking for them.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about hunting down the copies of these films?
Well, basically there are a couple of ways. Obviously, Turner Classic Movies is just a wonderful resource because they have a lot of things that you can't find elsewhere. There are also a number of people who collect these kinds of films, and I've struck up correspondence with many of them. And sometimes you can say to a very small group that you're looking for a particular movie, and they'll come up with it. So we've found, especially a lot of the films put out by studios that no longer exist, like Monogram, for example, from these collectors.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. If you have a question for Robert McLaughlin or Sally Perry about the movies, feel free to give us a call and join in on the conversation. The number to call is 333-9455, or if you're outside of the 217 area code, call 800-222-9455. You had mentioned I believe it's in the introduction somewhere, that an average of 90 million Americans were attending the movies each week in the early part of the 1940s.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, you figure it this way. A lot of things were rationed, including gasoline, so you couldn't travel a lot or do a lot on vacation. So people would go to the movies, and most people went to the movies at least once a week. I found a diary from my mother from the early 1940s, and she listed a whole bunch of movies, and we were sitting there saying, yes, we've seen this, yes, we've seen that, and it didn't seem unusual for somebody to go to the movies once or twice or sometimes even three times a week if the bill changed that often.
Sure. How important were the movies at this time in just communicating with the American people?
Well, I think extremely important, mostly because they were, of all the pop cultural media, they probably were the ones that had the greatest dissemination. People were able to get ideas about what was going on in the war from the movies that was very different from what they could get from the news. The news is, as you know, always very incomplete. There are things that we don't know. There are things that we can't be told because of national security or whatever. Whereas films could present a completed narrative with the characters that were recognizable and a story that pointed towards some kind of resolution. And these could take the, we think, chaotic experiences of the war that people had at the time and put them into something that was ordered and knowable, understandable for them.
Mm-hmm. I've heard this comment before that, you know, the movies during that period were really just propaganda pieces for the war effort. But they, I imagine some were, but some were a lot more complex than that, weren't they?
Right. Propaganda is an awfully loaded term, and so we try to avoid using it. You know, people use the word propaganda as very dismissively. Oh, we don't have to think about this as art because it's just propaganda. These films, one of the reasons that they're very successful in communicating ideas about the war is that they work very effectively as pieces of art. To think of them simply as, oh, well, they were just there to make us hate the Nazis or to get us waving the flag, to elicit some kind of an emotional response in us, I think is very much oversimplifies what they were doing.
What were the economics for the movie producers at about this time? You know, they were still in it to make money, right? They wanted these movies to turn a profit. So what were the economics? How important was the European market, the foreign markets to movie producers?
Well, the European markets were very important. So actually, in films that were made prior to the war, most of those films tended to be very careful about identifying the enemy. So a lot of times, there were a lot of spy movies that were made in the late 1930s, for example. And very often, the enemy had German names, and they spoke with German accents, but they weren't identified as Germans. There's an exception, of course, for something like Confessions of a Nazi Spy, but quite often the fascist activities were taking place sometimes in just sort of some general European locale, or sometimes in a country that was totally made up. So I think that prior to the war, that's what studios were trying to do to not cut off their European market. However, once by the very late 1930s, early 1940s, the Germans had cut off the market. Now, we still had quite a market with England, for example, but because of the economic situation in England, a lot of times films that were made, sometimes films were actually made in England so that the money, the profits that the studios made could actually be spent over there.
Mm-hmm. You, as you sort of divide up your material, you look at movies prior to Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. So what was the historical setting at that point in time, prior to Pearl Harbor, as far as movie making was set?
Well, it was kind of a complicated situation. As you say, the studios were mostly interested in making money, and some things never change. But at the same time, many of the artists in Hollywood and the people who owned the studios themselves were very, very critical of Nazi Germany, very anti-fascist, while opinion polls were telling us that most of the public was not. Hollywood was very ahead of the curve. So there's this kind of a tension between the desire to make films that could alert the public to what's going on with Nazi Germany, but at the same time not make films that are too much out of step with what the American public, you know, wants to hear or see. So you get a large variety of films. Mm-hmm. Some of the ones that Sally was talking about, spy films, where you've got people with vaguely, you know, Central European accents as villains, or films that would be made about World War One, but all of a sudden World War One, after years of having been treated by Hollywood very cynically, all of a sudden World War One is being presented as this very idealistic conflict again, as if they were displacing the current conflict in Europe back to the 1914-1918 conflict. So there's a lot of, kind of one step forward, two steps back sort of things going on in movies made at that time.
And also Congress was, there was a committee in Congress that was concerned that Hollywood was trying to push the United States into war, and there was actually a committee that brought in the heads of the studios to testify about that as to whether or not they were being sort of pro-interventionist. And unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, but the committee ended up ending for the end of the congressional term, and then Pearl Harbor happened, so the committee was never reconstituted.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the movies then, as you mentioned in your book, really sort of highlighted that reluctance of the American populace, anyway, to get involved in the conflict over in Europe. And talk a little bit about a movie like Sergeant York and what was said in that movie.
Well, sure. Sergeant York is a terrific example because it was based on, you know, the actual Alvin York, who was a hero during World War One. He was played by Gary Cooper in the film. And he's presented, you know, basically as an American isolationist. He's from the part of the country, the Tennessee Hills, where they don't, you know, they take care of themselves and not really worried about the outside world. And he becomes, you know, converted to, you know, becomes very religious. And when he becomes drafted, he wants to be a conscientious objector. He can't, you know, the book says that killing is wrong, and I ain't going to go against the book, he keeps saying. When he goes to boot camp, he gradually gets persuaded that he owes a duty to his country to serve in the army. That's an important thing to support as well. He becomes a hero eventually over in Europe. It's like the message that's being sent is that, you know, America's taking this isolationist position, and they're taking it for good reasons, but, you know, they owe it to the rest of the world. They have to go over and help protect the countries that are being attacked by countries that would deny them the kinds of freedoms that we hold so dear.
Mm-hmm. Any other movies during that particular era that are good examples of America's position politically at that point in time?
Well, a similar one to Sergeant York is The Fighting 69th, yet another one that deals with displaces the conflicts of the war onto World War One. An interesting one is Foreign Correspondent, which is a Hitchcock film with Joel McRae, who plays a foreign correspondent who goes over there and, somewhat like Sergeant York, doesn't know much about the world conflict, is sent over actually for that reason, because he's kind of a blank slate. And his character name is Johnny Jones. He's supposed to be the average American sent over just to see what's going on. And through the course of the film, he discovers that the fascist threat is real, that it's insidious, and that even people who seem to be nice, like the young woman he falls in love with, actually can be fascists as well. And so as he's learning about how fascism sort of creeps into a country, he's being educated at the same time. And we think that this film was interesting because as Johnny Jones is being educated, the movie-watching public is educated as well.
Mm-hmm. Our guests this morning are Robert McLaughlin and Sally Perry. They have written a book called We'll Always Have the Movies, The American Cinema During World War II. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, you can. Our number is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We did have a listener call with a question. They want to know of the Bogart films, film Sahara. How did it differ from the norm, and where did it fit into Bogart's career when you're talking about World War II films?
Well, it's an interesting movie for a lot of reasons. One of the things that we look at it for is its presentation of the Italian character. At one point, Bogart and his tank crew, they're lost in the desert. They come across a British, where is he from, British Guiana?
No, East Sudan.
East Sudan, a soldier who has an Italian prisoner. And he, usually the Italians as an enemy are presented very comically, not taken very seriously in the movies, and this guy is. He's you know, at first Bogart wants to, not going to take him along on the tank. We don't have enough food. We don't have enough water. We're not going to feed it. He says we're not going to take along a load of spaghetti, and the guy starts pleading. He says, well, you know, I can speak English. I've got my wife's brother's cousin works in a steel mill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Maybe he made the steel for this tank. You know, he turns himself from being a cliche, an object, into a real human being, and at that point, well, then they take him along. It's very, very, very interesting.
It's also interesting because Tambul, the Sudanese soldier, is black. He's played by Rex Ingram, who also played Delord in the movie The Green Pastures. And having a strong black character, he's treated like everybody else, and I think was really important at the time. It's interesting that when this tank group also captures a German flyer that the German treats the black soldier with tremendous disdain. And when he's when the German soldier is trying to escape, he tries to bring the Italian in to help him with the escape, but he's stays very far away from the Sudanese soldier. And I think that it's interesting for showing the tension among the various members of the Axis and the Allied groups. As far as how it fits into Bogart's career, Bogart made films throughout the war, couple as sort of pseudo-gangsters and something like All Through the Night, which came out right after the war began, in Casablanca, of course. In this one, I think he's a little bit more hard-bitten. This is usually the films that he makes are in a more urban setting, and for him to be out in the desert in sort of an all-male movie was a little unusual.
Mm-hmm. We've had another question from a listener. They want to know how many other films had black actors in such prominent roles.
Not a lot. Although there was the Office of War Information encouraged film studios to create films that showed America as a very inclusive society. It wasn't that common. Of course, there's Sam in Casablanca, mm-hmm. played by Dooley Wilson. There's Black in Hitchcock's Lifeboat. One of the people in the lifeboat is a black steward played by Canada Lee. In Bataan, which is about a small squad of Americans on the Bataan Peninsula who are basically supposed to keep the Japanese from building a bridge across the ravine. One of them is a black soldier. He plays a major role in that. Destination Tokyo.
Yeah, there's one of the soldiers. He's actually a cook, which was for actually the first half of the war. Most of the black military men were in support roles as cooks, as cooks or other kinds of support roles. Comes out of the ship in order to help with a mission on shore. And I'm sorry, the movie is actually Crash Dive rather than Destination Tokyo. But in general, you'll see black civilians or black soldiers in a lot of train scenes and as kind of background, but I'd say probably a dozen movies or fewer in which black actors had some kind of major role, especially in the military. I mean, on the home front, you'll get sometimes maids, people like Hattie McDaniel, who are maids and then decide to chuck it so that they can serve the war effort, so they basically go and work in factories instead. And that's kind of interesting culturally that prior to the war, a lot of middle-class people had, not servants exactly, but they would have a cook or a housekeeper or something. After the war, that's very, very uncommon because a lot of these people ended up working in factories, made a lot more money, had a lot more free time, and decided that they didn't want to go back into that kind of position.
Mm-hmm. Things changed after Pearl Harbor in the direction of the movies. One of the interesting points you bring out in the book is that the movies were used to educate the American public on like where these islands were and how they were located, and why this front was important to us in America.
Sure.
What were the techniques that were used to communicate that?
Right. Yeah, historians tell us that the Japanese were counting on a negotiated peace that would allow them to keep most of the territory that they really wanted and to give up some of the stuff that they didn't really want. And this was based on their conviction that the Americans weren't going to be willing to fight and die for a bunch of islands that they'd never heard of, whose names they couldn't even pronounce. We think that the Hollywood films, one of the things that they were doing in the films about the South Pacific was to show how those places could be seen as part of America. There are several films, the Air Force is an excellent example, that begin with the characters on the west coast of the United States, and they're going off towards Pearl Harbor or the Philippines, and we get these animated maps that show their path. You get that also in Wake Island. You get it in So Proudly We Hail. These films are trying to, extend the West Coast to include these other places. In films like, all three of those films I just named, the American characters are always arriving at places and they run into old friends, family members, someone who served with their father in the military. It's presented as this huge extended family. And the idea of giving up these places would be like betraying your family. It becomes very, very emotional. In So Proudly We Hail, which is about a group of nurses primarily in the Philippines during the fall of the Philippines, Claudette Colbert at one point says, "Oh, Mindanao, Bataan, those aren't American names, but they've turned into American graveyards." The films were always trying to send these messages that these places really were American places.
Yeah, and so you'll see through, especially in films made about the Pacific, that there are always going to be maps that show very much where they're going, how they're connected to one another, so that the audience is continually reminded, okay, here's how it fits together. So in some ways, you know, it almost serves like a geography lesson. Mm-hmm. This is why we know about the places that we're fighting.
Because a lot of people in this country at the time didn't know where these places were. Is that correct?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hawaii was not a state at this point. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Japanese assumed that because Hawaii was not a state, just a possession of the United States, that when they bombed it, that the United States would just sort of withdraw because the Japanese were trying to create a sphere of prosperity in Asia, kind of governed by them. And they were, I think, kind of taken aback that the United States responded so strongly and so immediately. It's interesting that the theme of betrayal of the Japanese shows up in movies throughout the war, and that as the Japanese were getting ready to bomb Pearl Harbor, there were two emissaries from Japan that were going to Washington to try and supposedly negotiate some kind of settlement. And in film after film, you see certain kinds of you'll see those two emissaries sort of pop up at various places, and it's a reminder of the betrayal. It's kind of like in many films throughout the war, and even to this day, there'll be something to indicate the date, and the date stands for so much more than just December 7th, the bombing of Pearl Harbor. It stands for a sort of larger betrayal and the reason for the Americans to get involved in the war. So somebody will say, "Oh, what's the date today? Oh, December 6th. And so you know what's going to happen. So in many of these films, the audience is just waiting in anticipation because that date stands for so much.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller on line number one. Let's go to line one. Champaign County, you are on the air with Robert McLaughlin and Sally Perry. And do you have a question?
Yeah, I haven't seen many of Bogey's movies, but I have never heard anybody discuss the one called Beat the Devil. This was written by Claude Coburn, an Irishman who was father of political gadfly Alexander Coburn, and it's the only film that Bogey did with Sophia Loren, I guess, and it has some interesting dynamics in it, personal dynamics, but it also includes the thing that's being smuggled is yellow cake, uranium, so I gather maybe they were trying to inform people about what was coming in the nuclear age or something, if you take your idea of film as educative. I understand that it was Coburn almost put the famous name of the ghostwriter or the writer who's indicating that the screenplay writer no longer or the author no longer took credit for it. I'm not sure if it really went that far. But it was edited quite a bit. I don't know if you know any of that story.
Well, Beat the Devil is a little past World War II because it came out in 1954.
I just was making a parallel to the idea that it was educative, not.
Sure. And you can think of something too, like that earlier Hitchcock film that comes out right after the war, Notorious, with Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman, where there's also kind of what he calls the myth, the MacGuffin of uranium being smuggled. Beat the Devil is interesting since it kind of returns to, in some ways, to some of the earlier spy films of the 1930s in the way that the smuggling is kind of is going on.
But you don't know anything about if the screenplay was contentious and what might have been left out or anything?
Not offhand. I know that John Huston and Truman Capote were the ones who were more or less responsible for it. It's the time considered kind of a satire of Maltese Falcon-like movies on and since it was done on location in Italy, there were a lot of changes as they discovered what could and couldn't be done. I know it wasn't very popular at the time, although it's sort of become a cult favorite since then.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I wanted to raise it as a film that people can seek out because it is interesting. But I've always wanted to know. I suppose I could Google it and see if somebody did a comparison of the screenplay as proposed and what I'd forgotten, or maybe I never knew that Capote had anything to do with rendering it. Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. The number to call if you'd like to join in on the conversation is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You're listening to Focus 580. I'm Les Schulte. I'm filling in for David Inge this morning. Our guests are Robert McLaughlin and Sally Perry, and we're talking about their book, We'll Always Have the Movies, American Cinema During World War II. The movies were used, of course, set a stage on how we viewed our enemies, the Germans, the Japanese, the Italians at the time, and how were films used in that regard?
Well, there were actually sort of prototypes for the Germans since the Allies had fought the Germans in World War I. One of the things that we discovered is that many of the portrayals of the Germans in World War II were based on those sort of earlier models, and you think of people like Otto Preminger, for example, Laird Krieger, who played the very sort of, Otto Preminger played the sort of Prussian-type officer. And then you have the Nazis that were a little bit more educated, a little bit more sophisticated, who seemed to hate what they were doing, but at the same time took great pleasure in it. Sort of Laird Krieger comes to mind, for example, George Saunders. One of the interesting things, though, is that in the portrayal of the Germans, it wasn't all the Germans were bad and that's why we should fight them. There was actually a lot of gradations in the presentation of not only the German soldiers, but also the German people, so that when you watch the movies about Germany, there were some Germans that were considered good, or at least Germans that may have fallen into the Nazi sphere because of fear, because of the way they were educated. And so when Americans watched those types of films, they were aware that the Germans were not a sort of a monolithic, awful people, that the Nazis were, of course, to be disliked and fought and so forth, but that they weren't all bad.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's one of the things you read frequently is that at the beginning of the war, the Germans were just presented as monolithically evil, and that it was only towards the end of the war that you started getting distinctions between Nazis and other Germans. And in our experience, that's not true. It's from before the war, before Pearl Harbor through the end of the war, you're getting films where there will be distinctions made between different kinds of Germans. The Italians, as I said earlier, were rarely taken seriously as an enemy. Just as there were traditions for how to present Germans in show business on stage and in movies, there were stock Italian types, and Hollywood tended to draw on them. The situation with the Japanese was much more interesting, because although Hollywood had stock Asian types, before Pearl Harbor they'd never had occasion to make huge distinctions between, say, Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, Philippines. And after Pearl Harbor they did. And so that becomes very, very interesting. You rarely get a film that makes a distinction between, evil Japanese and good Japanese. They're usually presented very homogeneously as our enemy. Furthermore, they're not always individualized in the same way that the Germans are in films about the Eastern European theater. It's more like masses of men, usually faceless. We rarely get close-ups. When we do get a character who's individualized, one of the tropes that's frequently used is the idea that they had been educated in the United States and then have gone back to Japan to use this education against us. It's very, very interesting.
One of the most interesting films, though, is Behind the Rising Sun. It's the only one that we've ever found that shows the sort of gradations of Japanese people, the way that the Germans are also displayed, in that there is a young man who goes to the United States to get educated, comes back, and is full of American ideals. He wants to be, you know, an architect, and he works with an architectural firm in the United States, or an American firm in Japan. And what's interesting about it is that we see how he becomes kind of enculturated to accept what his father considers sort of Japanese destiny. He becomes involved in the military. He loses the interest in democracy, in various kinds of American ideals, and becomes part of the Japanese military machine. But rather than just showing that as sort of the end part of it, he has a girlfriend, and the girlfriend is offered a chance to escape Japan and go to the United States, which he's wanted to do throughout the film. And she says, no, I want to be here so that when the Americans win, they'll know that there are some Japanese that they can work with. And it's a very touching moment. Also in the film, the father realizes that the Japanese military machine has just gotten totally out of hand, and it has sort of dehumanized all those people that he loves. And so he kills himself at the end rather than face a world in which everybody that he knows has just become so awful.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller, but before we get to the caller and before we move off of this subject, talk a little bit about the movie Little Tokyo, USA. And that really brings that movie brings up the fact that even Japanese Americans cannot be trusted in this country at this point in time.
Right. Little Tokyo, USA was made very quickly after Pearl Harbor, and it was made so quickly, in fact, that the Office of War Information was really upset about some of the ways that it was presenting issues. But, yeah, it's set in Los Angeles, I think, just before Pearl Harbor, and it's showing this Japanese spying, all these Japanese people who are, many of them are Japanese, they're American citizens of Japanese ancestry, but their allegiance is to the emperor. And there's an American newspaper reporter who's trying to figure out what's going on to crack the spy ring, I'm trying to think what happens.
Well, at the end, they find the spy ring, and it ends with the roundup of the Japanese for the internment camps. And what's kind of scary, at least for a modern audience, is that they actually use real film clips of the Japanese being herded into the Santa Anita racetrack, which was sort of the grounds where they got all the Japanese together before they took them out to the internment camps. And the end part is a female broadcaster reciting this poem called Be Vigilant America. And the whole idea is that the enemy are everywhere. It's a very paranoid ending.
Right.
And very, very scary.
And it's very unusual for these films to acknowledge the internment of the Japanese American citizens. This film really stands out.
Let's go to line number four. We have a caller on the line. Good morning. You're on the air with Robert McLaughlin and Sally Perry.
Hey, thank you. I wanted to ask a few questions related to the film series Why We Fight. I believe it's by Frank Capra, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes.
I guess I wanted to know, for one thing, was it shown, who was the intended audience? Was it mainly the folks in the military or for people in the theaters as well during that time? And what impact do you think that it had? And I'll hang up. Thank you.
The initial intended audience was for people in the military, people who were drafted, who were enlisted. They were supposed to be educated as to why they were fighting the war. But they were so effective that most of them ended up being released in theaters for the general public, and at least one of them won a Documentary Academy Award, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, and they're very effective. They're really good filmmaking. Propaganda tends to be used as a dirty word, but these are excellent propaganda because they use images and ideas and narration, they blend them together beautifully to get across ideas to their audience. The first episode especially, where they're making a contrast between the free world, our world, and the world of fascism, the dark world, their world. It's beautiful in its simplicity, but it just establishes these ideas, everything you need to know about why fascism is a threat to the way of life that we've inherited. The divide and conquer episode, where it shows Hitler taking over Europe, is just beautifully done, the way it takes a series of complicated historical events and puts them into sequence so that you can follow very easily how one thing led to another.
And it's also interesting, too, because Frank Capra also uses the idea of the maps, showing how Nazi Germany has taken over the various countries, and in the way that it's set up between the two, the countries are presented in light colors, and as they become fascist countries, they turn dark black, as though the creeping fascism is actually turning the countries into this sort of really dark, threatening mass. And we find it very interesting also the use of music, the use of actual documentary clips from of various historical personages, of various military actions and so forth, is blended in very skillfully. Frank Capra was certainly among the best directors of his day, and you can certainly see how he used the skills and techniques he had in studio movies for this particular purpose.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. How were movies used during this time to present our allies and why we should care for them? And, you know, why should America care about these people? The films were used to sort of create this, educate the American people on who these people were.
Exactly. And that was a big question. We were spending lots of money, a lot of Americans were dying to fight a war that wasn't on our soil. In many ways, it was a war for other people. I think Hollywood films tried to answer that in a couple of ways. Our main allies, we can kind of separate the British, the Soviets, and the Chinese from other allies who were mostly occupied by either Nazi Germany or by Japan. Because they tend to be treated differently. Our major allies, the films tried to do two things. The first is to show how we should value their culture, why they're great people. So in films like Mrs. Miniver, there's a lot of time spent looking at Britain's historical and cultural heritage and how wonderful it is. In films like, what's the Russian one with Gregory Peck? Days of Glory. We see a Soviet partisan group behind German lines, but they live in this underground bunker, but they sit there and they read Pushkin, and they have icons on the wall, and they play music. They rescue a ballerina who dances for them. I mean, there's all this art and history. But at the same time that we're supposed to value them for their uniqueness, we're also supposed to value them because they are becoming more like the United States. So in a lot of the films about England, for example, you'll see a democratizing impulse towards the end, the breaking down of the rigid class system. That happens in Mrs. Miniver. This Above All film with Joan Fontaine and Tyrone Power. He's very disaffected, lower-class person. Why should he be fighting for the privileged classes in England? And he becomes convinced that the war has to be won so that England can be remade for his kind of person.
And there's such a connection between England and America, at least in the way it's presented in the movies. I think of something like The White Cliffs of Dover, for example, where the main female character actually marries into a British family, and her son, and her husband dies in the war, her son dies in the war, but it's almost like they've become one people. So it's easy in the English films. In the Chinese films, it's a little stranger because the Chinese, for the most part, are often in the background. Even when the fighting is in China, there are not a lot of Chinese people that are sort of separated out. An exception is something like Dragon Seed, based on the Pearl Buck novel. And that's unusual because most of the main characters, although they're supposed to be Chinese, are played by Caucasian actors. And I think somebody seeing it for the first time, especially in contemporary society, thinks of it as very racist and very weird. And what we've decided is that, although I think contemporary sensibilities would probably confirm that, on the other hand, for people at the time watching it, they say, oh, they're like us. Assuming it's sort of middle-class white America, and so therefore they could see the connections better. In some of the other films about China, like China, for example, the Chinese people are becoming educated. Women are becoming educated. They want to become teachers. They want to become social workers. They want to get involved in moving society from sort of a medieval-type society to a contemporary society. And for them, that means becoming more like Americans. And so I think for those kinds of allies, that's very important. Mm-hmm. The occupied allies are a sort of different story.
One of the fun things that you bring out in the book is that they resurrected Sherlock Holmes to fight the Germans.
Oh, yeah.
And Sherlock Holmes and the Voice of Terror, and Sherlock Holmes and the Secret Weapon.
Oh, yeah. Sherlock Holmes and the Voice of Terror is really good. But yeah, a lot of series characters fought the Nazis. Tarzan fights the Nazis in a couple of movies.
That's right.
Sherlock Holmes gets updated by 40 years or so he can fight the Nazis.
Lassie fights the Nazis.
And the other scary thing that you bring out is that because of the Blitz, Bela Lugosi comes back as a vampire to stalk the streets of London, I guess. All right?
I know. It's bad enough that they have to face the bombs if there's this vampire wandering around.
Yeah, I know. So that's some fun movies there, too, to take a look at. And, of course, I have to touch on now one of my favorite films, Casablanca, as I mentioned right at the top of the hour. Let's talk a little bit about Casablanca and the importance that particular movie has in America's position in the war at this time, and what it has to say about the relationships between these countries during World War II.
Well, Casablanca is just a beautiful film. It's not really that it's unique in anything it does. It does things that a lot of other films does, but it does them so perfectly. We were talking before about the idea of taking kind of an American who needs to be educated as to why America has to fight in this war. That's Rick at the beginning of the movie. He's neutral America. You know, I stick my neck out for nobody. He says that all the time. We know that he's been involved in helping running guns to the Ethiopians and helping in the Spanish Civil War. Like America, he's been involved in international crusades before, and he's felt he's gotten burned, so he's become an isolationist. And the movie is all about bringing him out of that isolation and making him the kind of American who's ready to go off and fight the Nazis.
And also he's surrounded by people who represent the various allies and the various people from the Axis powers as well. Casablanca, in a sense, becomes a microcosm for world society, and you see the tensions being played out in Rick's cafe. We make a big deal in the book about the Marseillaise scene, because in that scene, virtually everybody comes together, and the battle between the Allies and the Axis is very pronounced. As the listeners may recall, the Germans are playing Watch on the Rhine very loudly, on an upright piano, and they're singing, and they're kind of off key, but they're loud and they're very bullying. And one person starts to sing the Marseillaise, and it seems like that person is standing alone against the German might. But over time, everybody joins in. Paul Heinried as Victor Laszlo leads them, and he's dressed all in white, kind of like he's all in white. He seems like the epitome of goodness. The Spanish guitar player, people from the various occupied countries throughout Europe show up, and they're singing the coming together of all these people from all of these countries who are either menaced by the Nazis or who have actually already been occupied by the Nazis. Their singing overwhelms the Germans, and the Germans finally stop. And it seems like, I think many people have just seen it so many times, it becomes obvious. But it's the power of all of these people working together. And in the film, it's musically rather than militarily. But the point is that if all these countries do work together, that they can overcome the fascist bullies.
You make a point about racism in that particular scene. To sort of bring up the comment that was made earlier about blacks being featured in movies. Here Sam is being featured very prominently in this movie up to that scene, and he's not included in that scene.
Right. It's very strange. Almost every other character in the movie is there. And for some reason, Sam is not. I don't, like, he have a long break just then? I don't know. But it's one of the things that we're thinking is that the whole point of the scene is it's about pulling together, good people pulling together under the right kind of leadership to defeat these Nazi bullies. And having Sam there would on one level be a reminder not of pulling together but of segregation, that in America that blacks are, in 1942, very much still second-class citizens. That it would have been disruptive at a moment where you didn't want anything disruptive. So I don't know if that was their actual reason or not, but mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it is kind of weird and pretty obvious that that he's not included in that scene. Interesting.
Right.
We have a caller on line 4. Let's go to line 4. Good morning. You're on the air with Robert McLaughlin and Sally Perry.
Hello. Would you discuss one of the really important films about World War II, especially about the philosophy of the time, Lifeboat?
Oh. Yeah. Lifeboat's a terrific movie and very interesting.
It's an allegory of the time, and nobody ever says that.
Well, yeah, it's, again, like Casablanca, you've got representatives from almost all the countries here. You've got Americans, you've got British, you've got someone from Canada, you've got a black character, you've got a millionaire character, you've got a communist character. It's this whole, you know, American society represented in that lifeboat. And then this one German Nazi character gets put in the middle of it, and what happens? If you've watched a lot of World War II movies like we have, what you expect to happen is kind of what happens in the Casablanca scene, is that the good people pull together and find a way to defeat the Nazi. But that's not what happens. The Nazi actually kind of finds a way to take over. And he does it by taking advantage of the values that the Allies are fighting for. He takes advantage of their sense of fair play, of their sense of democracy, of their sense of Christianity.
For the time, that was the warning, wasn't it?
Sure. Oh. Well, yeah, I think it was. But it also asked the question, is that if we're going to defeat the Nazis, how much like our enemy do we have to become in order to do it? And what's that going to do to our society after the war?
And look at our society. We are repeating it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's true. It's true. I mean, in Lifeboat, towards the end, the characters finally do come together, but they come together to kill the German and push him off the boat. And I've read the short story on which it was based, that was in a popular magazine at the time, and the short story is actually even more violent than that. And one of the other interesting things is that the black character, they're trying to vote on what to do with the
generally vote. Yes.
And
do I get the vote too?
Yeah.
Yes.
Do I get the vote?
And it's simple, but it's really damning of American society that he has to ask, does he get to vote? And later on, when they're praying over
it's a brilliant, unappreciated film, I think.
The black character is also the only one that knows the 23rd Psalm.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like he actually has more of the sort of tropes of civilization than the characters that are blowing and blasting about it. So it's a real social commentary.
The black character is also the only one who doesn't become a part of the mob that attacks the German at the end.
Well, yes, as I say, it's an unappreciated film, I think. I don't think people realize that it is an allegory of what was going on at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, thanks very much for your call. We have a couple of minutes left, Robert and Sally, and one film that I want to touch on just real quickly, if you can, is another Bogart film called All Through the Night, which sounds like it sort of is typical of the movies as they present the folks back home at that point in time, and kind of like how, there again, Bogart's sort of playing that character where he's an isolationist, doesn't really care, and as the movie goes along, he switches his sentiments.
Right, he's kind of a good-natured Broadway gangster, and he's not interested in the war. He's just interested in making his little profits. And a friend of his mother's is murdered by Nazis, and he starts investigating it. And as he does, he finds out more and more about how the Nazis actually operate, and that it's not just something that's happening on the other side of the ocean. It's something that's a threat to the way of life that even, you know, gangsters appreciate here in the United States.
And it's interesting, too, because the structure of the film, it starts off kind of like a comedy. Even the people who are playing his sidekicks are people like Phil Silvers, William Demarest, comedians from the time period. And so and they're looking at the war news, but they're kind of doing it like little toy soldiers and everything. And so at the beginning, you think it's, okay, very much a comedy of the time. And as he finds out more about how the Nazi threat is throughout the United States, the film gets a lot darker, a lot more serious.
Mm-hmm. They retooled it, didn't they, after, I mean, as they started the movie before Pearl Harbor, right? And then sort of re-scripted.
Yeah, at the beginning when they're what they're arguing about is Dunkirk, and then at the end, you can tell there's some really sloppy editing at the end, which makes me think that they did something to change it to bring it up to post Pearl Harbor.
You know, we're out of time already. this has been a very fast hour. I do appreciate your time.
Well, we've had a great time.
Yeah, Robert McLaughlin and Sally Perry, they've written the book "We'll Always Have the Movies." It's published by Kentucky University Press. And Sally and Robert, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You.